Welcome, everyone, to our Thursday night Stargate Roundtable. And we are here on this New Year's Eve celebration, and we are glad that you're here with us celebrating. So to begin, we'll pass the talking stick to Angel Sue so that she can set the tone and get us started. So Angel Sue, pass the talking stick to you.
Thank you, thank you. And Happy New Year's Eve, everyone. I have a personal request before we start that you hold up my nephew. His name is Jeremy, and he's been in a bad accident where the other motorist who was at fault was killed, and he's going through a lot of emotional trauma right now. He has some problems mentally and emotionally, and he's a very brave, young, new daddy. So, Jeremy, with survivor's guilt, I ask your prayers for him up in Iowa. And now, we're going to welcome you in the light of the most radiant one, in the office of the Christ, and only in the office of the Christ. And we're invoking the loving energies of Saint Germain and the violet flame. And we're asking now that you claim yourself as that divine, beloved child, loved and supported throughout all that you encounter. And so your team, number one, your higher self, and then your beloved twin flame, call them in, along with your guides, your masters, your teachers, your angels, your councils of light, and all those from the lighted realms that celebrate your path here, just that you exist. And we feel the same way. We're so glad you are you and you're here. So on this New Year's Eve, we're just going to call in with the Law of One, the most amazing miracles. And so for all the concerns of your heart and your mind, for all the things that you carry in your awareness, for your family, your friends, your associates, those who you claim, those that you're aware of with what's going on in the world and through the media, for all those that are white hats, black hats, we're calling in the most amazing, wonderful, happy, divine, perfect solutions. And with this, we're also holding up Nasara, the Reformation Act, our white knights, Faction 3 white knights, and also our galactic forces of light, and whistleblowers, and media people that are going to be supporting, spreading this wonderful information about how our lives change into more sovereignty and freedom and prosperity. All amazing technologies coming forth that have been withheld. Healing for anything. And much more than we can even begin to understand what is truly available to us. So with this, on New Year's Eve, we are calling in all the beings, known and unknown, seen and unseen, from all time and space, from all of creation, all parallels, all potentials. And we welcome them all to find the highest good through the Law of One. For we are all one. And as one is harmed, then all are harmed. Yet as one is helped, then all are helped. And therefore, in the name of who we are, then we are one with all there is. Owati, Owati, Owati. and we ask that only the highest good of all concerned happen here, there, and everywhere, for every person, place, condition, and thing. And we give thanks that this is done with Rainbird's 13 thank yous and honey in the heart. And with this, we're going to close now by saying all men, all women, all children, all beings, all creation, we are all one. And with this love, we celebrate the beginning of new potentials for the highest joy, the highest happiness, the highest healing. And with this, I pass the talking stick.
Well, thank you, Angel Sue. We always appreciate you getting us started. And we hold your Jeremy in the loving space and give him a lot of support. Tonight, for our dear little Rainbird, she is working with her family and so will not be with us. About the only thing that I will pass along, I have my new Jim Maynard Celestial Influences calendar in front of me. And I had some people ask me today where they could find that. And there's a company in Columbus, Ohio here that a friend of mine has. It's Phoenix Books, and it's 614-268-3100. And Bob Peters has had this. He's a professional astrologer and has had this bookstore and always brings lots and lots of books to our Radionics conferences. And so this is something that gives you all the astrology. It tells you when Mercury's or where all the planets are every day. So I'll just tell you that Mercury goes retrograde on the 6th, which is next Wednesday. The new moon is the 9th, and the full moon is the 23rd. So those are just things that you can see readily. And as they say, I am not an astrologer at all. And this gives me enough information that I can do my planting with the biodynamic system, and I also use another biodynamic calendar. But this is something that if you're interested in, it's just called Celestial Influences for 2016. And there's an East Coast division and a West Coast calendar, either one. And it's Jim Maynard, Celestial Influences. And if you do want to call the bookstore and get you a copy, it is 614-268-3100, and they're on Eastern Time, and this is Phoenix Books in Columbus, Ohio. So with that, we have a knowing that this is a perfect place for all of us to be sharing. Tara and Rama have a lot of information for us that they're going to be sharing tonight. We don't have an outside guest. We have inside guests, and they are Tara and Rama. So if you enjoy having us be here. We always accept donations for keeping the show on and also for supporting Tara and Rama. So you can email me at stargatemarita@gmail.com, or you can call me at 317-773-0061, and I can tell you how you can get some support to them if you choose to do that. So with all of that said, we thank all of you who are working with us. And Kathy said that she is back up and would like Doug to call her again. So if you hear this, she's waiting to be called. There she is. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Kathy, are you there now with us? Are still coming in? Looks like it failed. All right. Well, we'll hear from her later. And so now we will pass the talking stick to Tara and Rama and see what kind of information they have out there, who they've talked to. We're still trying to get Kathy, it looks like.
Yeah, I don't see her. You know, I don't see her up here on the board.
Well, they're trying, and it's the call's failing, so I can see that.
Maybe they can try her just directly on her phone instead of trying to get her up on Skype and see if she's home.
She is, and she's. I've texted with her, and that's where she told me she's back up, and wanted to be called. But that was 5 minutes ago, so maybe, you know, whatever has happened. Okay, Tara.
All right.
Talking stick. Sure.
All right, Kathy, if you're hearing this, to call up Doug and figure it out. How's that? Okay. Greetings, everyone. Well.
Greetings.
I was just going to say we are having quite a, you might say, climate change going on our planet right now.
Big time.
And it's like it hasn't happened before. First of all, yesterday the temperature went up 50 degrees at the North Pole. That's not okay.
No.
And they've had
50 degrees.
It raised from the normal temperature
right up
50 degrees. It's usually about 30 to 40 below zero.
Right.
And now it's like 17 degrees above or something like that, 40 or 50 degrees higher. And that's
And we
just,
do have Kathy with us now. Say hello,
hello.
Kathy. Anything that you want to contribute before we let Tara get going here?
No, lots of love, everybody. Happy New Year.
Okay. Oh, Happy New Year, Kathy. Are you guys still having all kinds of lovely weather over there?
It's still warmish. It's in the 50s.
Outrageous.
We got up in the 40s today, so it's not a normal winter so far.
Yeah. Well, guess what? What's normal? The new normal.
Yeah, some people don't think that's too funny right now.
Yeah, some of it's not so funny.
So what's the temperature in where you are, Tara?
Well, it was almost zero here last night, and it was 17 below zero where Deanna is in Idaho Falls.
It's supposed to get down to 13 tonight.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Yes. But
13
then it's
below or 13?
13 above zero.
13 wow. above. But
okay.
But up there in Idaho Falls, it was 17 below yesterday evening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to get colder. And
that's
so
winter. It is winter time, my dears.
Well, yeah, but nothing is normal anymore. Let's put it that way. And
Yes, if you have anything to say, well, you just chime in. And
okay.
Carolyn is not with us tonight. She's off doing some family things, and we'll...
Angel Sue?
And Angel Sue was here. She did have some... her nephew was driving a semi-trailer delivering grain to some people, and someone pulled out in front of them. And the person who pulled in front of him was killed, and so he's just a new dad about a month ago, and he's having real emotional challenges because he has killed someone, and it wasn't his fault. But so she's asked for prayers for him, for Jeremy.
Mm-hmm. I almost caused an accident today. I couldn't believe it. I was in shock, and as I was doing that, I was saying thank you to Archangel Michael for protecting me. I was having a conversation with Spirit, and I moved over to the left lane, not realizing that I thought I was already in the left lane. Oh, I made a big mistake. I made a mistake in traffic. So I was talking to Spirit the time that it happened. How odd, huh?
Mm.
Nothing happened. But I really could have gotten terribly injured, and it would have been my fault.
Well, maybe we have to do some of that more intense kind of stuff when we're not behind the wheel.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I wasn't being intense. I'm always talking to them, you know?
Right. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Anyway, lots of love.
Okay. All right, Rama, what were you saying?
Yes, Rama, what did you hear in school today?
I got to talk with Tom the Cat and Larry and Curly, and they're all just basically saying the fiasco that's going on in the district of criminals is still about the not telling the whole story. And Bernie Sanders is coming forward and saying the whole story. One of his supporters is a man who is somewhere between 21 and 27. And he put this in a campaign note. This man between 21 and 27 is going through a recent divorce, and he is a student. He owes astronomical amounts to the final death merchants, and he took his last $27 out of the bank and gave it to Bernie and said, I'm not sure how I'm going to eat tomorrow, but I'm giving it to you to because I know you're the real deal. And this is basically what Larry and Curly and Tom the Cat were saying to me, the biggest story going on in the midst of all the hype from Mr. Hare and the other, you know, distractions. The story of the least among us is the first and foremost story. And that's what Bernie is doing. Also, what they shared with me is also out there across the internet. The Sphere Alliance and the hawk-headed Horus people are here. And the portal of the sun is here, open, and more energies are pouring through the portal of the sun. And it's affecting the planet. It's affecting everybody right now. The solar flares are off the charts. People have said that they possibly, if it's clear, can see the aurora borealis all the way down to Eugene, Oregon. That's
pretty good. We've seen them down here sometimes.
Yeah. And
I really enjoyed that when I was in Sweden and Norway. I mean, God, they're gorgeous up there every year. But to get that far south is pretty good on this side of the...
Yeah, it means that the filaments, the plasma energy from the sun that's coming in, these limbs of plasma energy are actually coming in to interact with the atmosphere of Earth. It's not just physically what we see. What Larry, Curly, and Tom told me is these energies are from pure creator source. And it's raising everybody's frequencies up to the 12th dimension and higher. And this is why the 13 families are begging for attention in the only way they know how. And that is by acting out in a very, it's a cry for help, a desperate cry for help in the wrong way, of course.
And they put out a pretty scathing
article. Oh, we got to talk into...
They put out a pretty scathing article called Criminal Roots, a shocking expose on the Clinton family and their rise to power. Clinton family secrets revealed in shocking and damning essay. And some of the stuff we know, but it goes a lot deeper as to what's going on. And I don't want to read the whole thing. It's really bad. I mean, it's they've been doing child trafficking, and like we know, Mr. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have been doing child trafficking for at least between 10 and 20 years, even though they're doing the song and dance they're doing out there. And It's getting clearer and clearer that you cannot serve Wall Street and serve the people at the same time. And I'm just saying it's about time. And then also there's an article from the Vatican, and everything in this Vatican story is going to change with Nassara law.
Yeah.
You know, at this point in time, they have something they call motu propria, and they're saying that's the highest form of legal instrument on the planet in accordance with its provenance, influence, and structure to the Western Roman world. All of that's canceled because it's all fraud. And the chair of Peter doesn't have anything over the ascended masters or the elders.
Yeah, the solar tribunal steps into this story.
And that's what we're – I wanted to really point that out because there's – all kinds of articles. Rama, there's articles. What's that called again? UNG.
Oh, this thing. These documents that this character M1 has sent out.
And
along
Neil
with
Keenan,
Neil Keenan.
And they're all compromised. And none of this is going to happen. Just
no,
want
it's not.
Everybody to not get lost in this stuff.
It is a real dog and pony show to get you lost in the miasms of
and
what they're playing with.
We're not making any comments about the individual integrity or not of the individual, but they're in a web that is not of the light.
That's right.
Kevin of
and
the.
And we have a question from one of our listeners who says, "What can Rama tell us about Andrew Basiago, who's coast to coast and says he's been in the secret space program and is going to run for president in 2016.
Yeah, he's compromised too, Marina
and
Roberts.
It just, well, she's asking, is he of the light? He says he was told he would be president one day like Mr. Obama. And so that was the question that she has just sent in and asked me to pass along to you.
Yes, Rama, go ahead.
What I can say is... Andrew Basiago, yes, he did go to Mars, and he survived.
And when he was a young person, he was told that.
And he survived just like Obama survived on the surface. But I'll make the differentiation here. These folks do not speak with Lord Monca or Lord Corton of Mars.
Or anybody of the Ashtar Command, they don't
That's
recognize
right.
that.
They really have not gone in to the cities of Mars that I have seen in the interior, and these are as beautiful as the cities of Lemuria and Atlantis.
And didn't you say that he got involved with, what's his name, Andre from Kuala Lumpur?
Oh, Alfred Weber.
Yes.
And Alfred Weber got compromised by Gordon Duff.
Yeah, and Gordon Duff is compromised all the way.
I mean, this is a web that goes all the way up to the 13 families where they send out their goons with the suitcases full of money and the Uzis and the other concealed fire sticks. And
see, but let's
they show up and they say, you know, non-disclosure deal here. You sign on the dotted line. You want to put three drops of blood on the paper? That's your business. But there's a deal here, and let's just say, you know.
It's all not in – it's trying to keep the 13 families in power.
That's right.
Without getting into any more. And it's really – it's got to stop being about money because it's not
right.
about money. And so the King of Swords, the day before Christmas Eve, said he provided some correctional information, and it has to do with the short version of Nassara, which you can find if you click on the top panel where it says Nassara information, and it's number 8. And so we're just going to read the correction, and that will eliminate all the other stories. And it says here, the way it was It said establishes new presidential and congressional elections within 120 days after Nasara's announcement. The interim government will cancel all national emergencies and return us back to constitutional law. So this is the correction material. So we just start with 8A. Barack Obama, and he wrote it this way on purpose, Barack Obama was never not the true president of the United States of America. He was elected in Nasara law. Therefore, he is not going anywhere. 8B, there will remain in Congress after the arrests, 64 good members. The original wording of point number 8 was first created by Dove of Oneness. Then Daddy Bush, number 41, changed the wording of that point and reduced the Nasara bill from its original 250 pages down to 75 pages. He called it the National Economic Stabilization and Recovery Act instead of the National Economic Security and Reformation Act. Daddy Bush also proceeded to set up two disinformation websites with the false name, calling them Nasara.com and Nasara.org. Dove's website was called Nasara.us, which was for the most part on the right track at the beginning of this long, long saga. 8C, the next piece of this point number 8, the remaining 64 good members of Congress will be working, this is very important, will be working together with the wise council of elders of the Ashtar Command, which includes members of the Brotherhood and Sisterhood of the Monastery of the Seven Rays. The Brotherhood and Sisterhood of the Seven Rays had known existence countless ages before, during the time of the elder race upon the earth about 1 billion years ago. However, it had never before had a monastery where students of life, highly advanced on the great path of initiation, could come together in spiritual harmony to blend the flow of their life streams. Each student came into existence on one of the seven great rays of life, as we all do, and the were to be blended by each student, weaving his or her ray as though it were a colored thread into the tapestry which symbolized the spiritual life of the monastery. Therefore, it was called the Brotherhood and Sisterhood of the Seven Rays, also known as the Brotherhood and Sisterhood of Illumination. This original material, upgraded, came from The Secret of the Andes by the author Brother Philip of the Amethystine Order of Saint Germain. The Ashtar Command is also bringing in as its ambassadors intergalactic delegates to Shambhala the Greater, located over the Gobi Desert, as well as calling on representatives of the Agartha Network, such as King Rantu and Lady Master Meru, Lord Adama and Commander Anton of the Silver Fleets. All of these beings are members of the Command, as representatives of Telos, the capital of the Agartha Network, along with all 100 inner Earth cities of light. Thus, Terra Nova, Tita Lacoria, the Diamond One, the New Earth, Terra Nova, yes, commences with all of humanity to live in peace and harmony in alignment with divine government, bringing heaven into earth in infinite bliss. Ahom Itakuyasin, in service to eternal peace and love, the King of Swords. So that's the place that has been revised. And that's the place why these wingmakerships are still pouring in through the portals in the sun. Now we're going on the third week. And there's also another quantum jump in the vibrational energy frequencies coming in through the sun as well. And so on these 12 days of Christmas, we're halfway through already, everybody. This is the sixth day of Christmas.
Yeah.
Okay, good heavens. So by the 6th of January, the day before Marita Roberts' birthday, we will be complete with this transition where all of the planets, including Uranus, going stationary direct on Christmas Day, so that all the major planets are moving forward. And so
this is moving huge, huge amounts of energy,
yes,
space-time, where, like Carl Boudreau has said, now it is in the 99% hands, how we change this. Bernie Sanders is one of those fingers of destiny changing this right now. The 13 families know it. They are absolutely terrified if Bernie gets the nomination and they put up their sock puppet, Donald Trump. I mean, Bernie will tear him up in the first 5 minutes. It's
not about Bernie, though, and Bernie keeps on saying this. It's really necessary, and it's not about being bored. And again, boredom is a tool for us to say, okay, let's go deeper. There must be something that's below the surface that I'm not looking at. And it's not necessarily, you might say, fun, right? Yet that's okay. It's about joy. Joy is another thing. It's about releasing all the programming from every lifetime. And that's the opportunity this new year with this forward and direct movement. And it really is about us actually doing this work. And as you don't know how to do this, there are so many avenues in just about every neighborhood there is.
Yeah.
You know, take a walk to, if you got a Whole Foods restaurant, Whole Foods health food store, and look on the bulletin boards. There's a yoga teacher every 2 inches, and there's color, sound, and vibrational healings, and there's just myriads of approaches. And learning about things that are going on with our bodies. There's a lot more stuff on PBS, and it's very good.
Yeah.
There's a lot more alternative minds, you know, moving away from the old medical patterns. And this other thing is extremely important. It's called Super Beats. But they are dealing with the power of nitric acid in the brain. And then there's there's important things that we lose real quick. The other one is the soil organisms along with the probiotics that can re-anchor the friendly bacteria in your gut. And then you've got the communication between the brain and the gut. And the fluid in the body that's feminine is your blood.
Yeah.
And so you've got this flow from the brain into your gut and throughout all of your organs, because the blood is activated in a way where the nutrition can actually reach all the cells in the body. And you can prevent things like Alzheimer's, all kinds of stuff. And Alzheimer's is growing so fast right now. It's kind of frightening. And of course, we haven't been taught these things. But let's take a chance and start looking. And again, for those of us who have an internet, which is a larger group than ever now, you can find the answers to these things at your fingertips. Really can. So,
and remember,
yes,
when we had Brent Courtwright about the neurogenesis, about the brain, and talking about body, mind, spirit. And that is a wonderful book and another resource. It's Brandt, B-R-A-N-T, Court, C-O-R-T-W-R-I-G-H-T. And it is another way of learning more about how to use all these things you're talking about in a total body, mind, spirit way. And I hope to have him back here in the next within the next 2 months. We're trying to work out a schedule. So,
okay, that's good. Now the weather is important. South China's Morning Post commented also on Japan's apology to South Korea for the exploitation of over 200,000 so-called comfort women during World War II. Yet the paper called for an apology only as a step forward, yet it's only the first step. And the comfort women themselves, there's only 50 of these comfort women still alive in South Korea. Yet the Japanese used quote-unquote comfort women in the Philippines, in Vietnam, in China, and in Indonesia. So there's many more. There's millions probably. So and what they haven't done is taken accountability in the legal manner to be responsible for those kinds of misuses of the feminine. And so there's pressure being put on Japan for that space. And again, go see Star Wars, The Force Awakens. And it does help to know more things about the ushering in now of the divine feminine to come in to bring this balance. So let's walk softly upon the earth, you know, as the native people talk about, you get your moccasins and actually feel her breathing, as Arundhati Roy says, you know, you can feel the heart pulse and the blood of Mother Earth is actually uranium, and let's get that out of here all the way. There is all kinds of stuff going on, Rama, with the...
And I was asked to say this by Tom the Cat. It is the 31st. Leonard Peltier is still not pardoned. Why is it that Leonard Peltier has not been pardoned and your friend Bill Clinton, Mark Rich, got pardoned? That's all I got to say.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Pardon for what? Here the question.
Leonard Peltier was...
He was accused of killing four FBI agents on the Lakota land Pine Ridge. Yes, and he did not do it, and the judge knew it. And the judge actually said in the decision that we know you didn't do it, but somebody's got to pay for it, and you're going to pay. And stuck him in jail for life. And he's been in there for how many, 36, 37 years now?
Yeah.
So, no, that's not acceptable.
Also, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah, he did not kill the policeman at all. And the person who did is known, and that person's been protected and... this person is paying the price. And so, and again, the King of Swords said it's rather blunt, but it's true. He said, we're going back, all the way back, because the atrocities of our police force, which are nothing different than the Stasi in the Fourth Reich, Germany, they have been carte blanche to kill people of color and anybody else that they don't like with impunity. And they will be summarily executed as this is turned around. And it's already turned around, yet the most important thing right now, because what usually goes on is, you know, how does Democracy Now! War and Peace report sound? We got to, you know, end the war part. And that means we need to love, you know, that little famous line, keep your friends close and keep your enemies even closer. And that's really a very important piece. And Martin Luther King did do that. And he did not judge people for whatever they're going through. But there is something that must be done here in terms of a commitment. It has to be a full follow-through. And, you know, Rosa Parks was destitute at times. And, you know, John Conyers saved her at one point in time because he gave her a job and made her his secretary, which brought some income in again. But, you know, she took 8 years before she did the first step that became public. She worked on being able to sit, you know, in the front of the bus you know, for 8 long years. And there was another young lady that actually did it before her and didn't actually make the breakthrough. But the persistence and the activation of the commitment to really be warriors for peace now is, I mean, we're just getting started. And this is why we started with this Bernie. It's not about Bernie. It's about going from moment to moment to moment and then making it a movement, a life path movement. That's what that number 8 is talking about. You know, we're moving into a life path of initiation with the elder race literally taking the chairs of all the people that got rested. We're going to have that kind of disclosure. That means we're pulling 1 billion years of guiding this planet, and Mother Earth said, now, you know, let's bring this tracking back to the right place.
If and you just take 2016, what kind of a year is that? It's a 9.
That is a completion of a whole cycle of love, right. Number 9.
Yeah.
And that could mean all your lifetimes.
So
it
this
could
is
be
a 9-year, and this it means finish up. It's the best time to complete something. And if you don't, you might carry it over into the next 9 years. So this is a very important year for us to do change.
Yes, not to say I know. I've heard a lot of little kids about 7 years old say, I know, and don't bug me. And then they don't do it.
Marina, are you talking about the year that just passed, or are you talking about the one we're going into now?
Well, the one we're going into now.
The 2016, so you add 2 and 1 and 6, that's 9. So that's
okay.
A 9-year.
There it is. Thank you.
Yeah, so the thing is that for those of us who have been working with the Mayan calendar and are aware of this, on 18th of August, which is a 9-day, but we began 2017 already. So for those of us who have been, you know, it's just like the Ophiuchian calendar too. You're two different things unless you're on the cusp. Like Rama's a Cancer in the 12 constellation calendar of the Western astrology. He's also a Cancer in the 13 moon cycle, both in the Ayurvedic as well as in the Ophiuchian astrology. And for me, I'm a Leo in the 12 constellation, and in the 13, I'm a Cancer. So now both Rama and I are Cancers. That's kind of interesting. You can take your chart and be both and. You can do this now. We're on these higher vibrational patterns now where we can comprehend a greater part of ourselves, and that just has to do with you're completing lifetimes of experience. Knowledge is absolutely has nothing to do with reality unless you take it out and experience by choice. Literally choose the experiences to go with that knowledge that comes with the numerology. You literally take those steps into your life, and they may be surprising to you. You don't even know until you really open your heart and take a risk. It is a risk.
And we might mention, if you wish to call in and ask questions or discuss any of these things this evening, 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. That's toll-free for United States and Canada, and it will give you an opportunity to ask questions if you want to talk about any of the astrology like we are discussing now or any of the things that are going on in the world. This is a good evening to do it because we are just discussing whatever is going on, and whatever questions that you might have, you're free to call in and ask those, and we'll have our panel of experts here, Tara and Rama, to answer your questions.
Yes, it is good to be engaged. We can the menu anytime. I was going to say that I wanted to read this because it's important, because we've just had 4 earthquakes in 10 days, just outside of L.A. And the last one was a 4.3, which was yesterday evening. And that's not cute. And at the same time in that area, just outside of L.A., there's also this methane gas plume, and it is huge. And it's just doing tons and tons and hundreds of tons of methane gas. It's spewing it all over L.A., 8 million people. And the people going to hospitals and getting respiratory illness and bleeding noses and mucus coming out of the eyes and lung problems, these things are magnifying themselves, and there's a whole movement that's starting to form. And what they're telling us is they don't know how to stop it. And as far as they can see, it might slow down on its own by April of next year. There's already dead people from this.
And
so,
where is it coming from?
It's coming from the ground.
A natural phenomenon, or is it because of the fracking?
Because of the fracking. They messed around, and they're still fracking the heaven out of that area, and it's not cute. And it's right on these fault lines. I want to just read this little piece. It's not very long, but it needs to be paid attention to. And, you know, this is another thing in the back of the minds of these characters, and it's been in the back of their minds when they can't get out of it anymore, and the banksters are got their, you know, a noose around their necks, and they do have a noose around their necks. They want to blow up something that has the banking system involved, and then they can blame it on that. Yeah, well, blow up the LA banking system, you know, and then you get your wish.
Or blame it on China with cyber warfare.
Yes, in the South China Sea, anywhere you can get your hands on something like this. But this is very touch and go here. This was on the Tom Hartman show. Somebody called in and he said, Diablo Canyon and its nuclear power plant and why it's so, why it should be shut down ASAP. Diablo Canyon fault line runs directly under the Unit 1 of the nuclear reactor in the turbine building. Yet that's not the worst story, Tom. 30 years ago, as Pacific Association / Electric decided to build a plant, they said there were no faults within 30 miles of the facility. And now we know that Diablo Canyon fault line connects it to something that runs east to west. And that connects to the recently discovered shoreline fault line. And that connects to the dreaded Hasquiri fault line, which is capable of a 7.0 earthquake magnitude quake scale. Diablo Canyon is only built to withstand a 7.5 on the quake scale, and it turns out that the Hasquiri fault line is a component of the San Andreas fault line, which intersects with the Cascadian subduction zone. And the subduction zone quakes are the largest quakes on the planet. They exceed 9.0 and upwards 10, 11 on the Richter scale of quake measurements. And being that all these fault lines are seismically linked, which has not been put out into the public, the power stored within the combined network of these faults could exceed easily by numerous numbers of magnitude the Diablo Canyon safety safeguards, and we could see a meltdown, a shaker in no time. There are all these fault lines seismically linked together right up to the Cascadia subduction zone to right under the Diablo Cove Unit 1 nuclear reactor. And Tom says, Harvey, you are spot on correct. And it's another demonstration of why nuclear power is such a crazy idea and needs to be completely shut down on the planet now. So that's a serious issue. And this leak, this methane gas leak, is right along those connecting quake lines, too. It's just irritating the heaven out of the whole thing. And now we just had four quakes. They're not that big, but it's serious. Wow. It's very, very serious. And so we cannot sit down on the job. And I saw hundreds of people in the neighborhood where they're getting really sick because it's right there. I mean, they had to evacuate thousands of people. And talking about evacuations, there's 160,000 people in five countries in South America that are getting rains and flooding to the point where whole buildings are underwater. And these people are homeless.
Just like in Missouri.
And the Uruguay River is running through Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, P. What's the name of that country that begins with a P in South America?
Paraguay?
No.
Patagonia?
No. No. Oh. Where Sonia lives?
Peru.
Peru! Yes. Yeah. And Argentina. Peru, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Brazil. Mm. Five countries in their southern parts are underwater. And then we've got a similar situation up there in northern England and Scotland and Ireland and the Isle of Man. All these thousands and thousands of people have lost their homes. They're all underwater, and they're going to get more. Same thing in South America, same thing up in there in the northern parts. And then, you know, the temperatures raising by 50 degrees on the North Pole, and the amount of melting there, that's not cute either, because there's trillions of tons of methane gas underneath that North Pole, and it's already started to leak, and on the floors of the oceans there's openings, and the methane gas is bubbling into the oceans, and the acidity of the oceans is going exponentially up, which is killing the coral reefs. There's over 60 to 70% of the coral reefs are already dead. I mean, we have ourselves on a red alert. It's not to scare people, because there are some simple answers, but it's just like we were talking about earlier, you know. A lot of times we know things, but we just are very slow to make that a part of our life and really make it a living experience. Now, this work that we can do, yes, we can, together as a group consciousness, and actually change our lifestyles to actually meet those truths that we know. You know, knowledge without the experiential active participation. That's why Tom always says, tag, you're it. Tag, we're all it. We make this real by, and Naomi Klein and Bill McKibbins. Mm-hmm. This was on Amy Goodman this morning. They had they actually had a trial, not just for ExxonMobil, for Standard Oil and for Texaco and for all the different companies. They all did it. It wasn't just ExxonMobil that knew that they needed to stop back in the 70s. They needed to stop the fossil fuel all the way in the 70s, or they were encroaching on a very – oh, that's another thing that happened today in Dubai. This hugely tall, 63-story tall building – went on fire. The whole building was on fire. And I mean, it's unbelievable. I'm looking at it right now again, and this reminded me.
It's near this building called the tallest building in the world.
Yes, right across the street.
And what caused the fire, and what's going on?
All they know is the people that were witnessed there heard explosions.
Yeah,
they don't really know.
To me.
They don't have it down yet. Downtown Dubai, the Burj Khalifa or something, That's I almost got the name of it there. Burj Khalifa L or something was the name of the building. It's not supposed to look like that, but it looks like, you know, when everybody else in all these different cities like are having these spectacular, oh, Sydney, Australia,
fireworks.
And in Paris and in Brussels, they decided not to do that. And there's all kinds of terrorist attacks that they're trying to prevent. All these things that the distractions are just being, they're crazy. We were going to play something, unless anybody's got any questions. But I think
it's time for our guest. It's the second hour, so if you have something that you want to present, I guess that's you're right on time.
Yes, and it's a real education, and we have played this quite a while ago before. Yet, they brought it back on free speech because of I would say the importance of this, and it's about the labor movement, because we're going into a new age where there's going to be robots and all kinds of help, and we're not going to be digging minerals out of the ground or gold or anything like that. We have divinations, we have abilities to manifest, and these things are going to stop. And
we're not going to be fighting droids in the future, no.
No, and we're not going back to the caveman either.
No.
So, but this is an informative piece that gives, you know, knowing the history so that we can move forward. And then we're going to have some Philharmonic music for a little while, and Rama picked a few pieces of good New Year's music, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if that's okay with everybody, let's see, what's there? Even though I am a Leo but a Cancerian according to the Vedic astrology. Oh, Kathy! You too, Kathy. When's your birthday, Kathy?
Sorry, I was just writing that for the board, everybody, because you were talking about both of you being Cancerians in one hand. And I know that through the Vedic astrology, my August 14th birthday does fall into Cancer.
Yeah, I'm on
personal August writing.
Yeah, August 5th, baby. So we're just, you know, 9 days apart.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and we're both Cancers. Yep, that's right. And then in the Ophiuchian astrology, Leo doesn't start until the ninth. So you would still be a Leo. Yeah, fascinating. And then it goes really long. It goes from the ninth until like the 16th of September. That's a pretty long cycle. And then you've got...
I was born in the house of Cancer when I was born, even though it was a Leo birthday. That was the house I was born in.
Uh-huh. And I kind of like those combinations. They're very interesting because Cancer is the house of the mother. And yeah. Leo is basically the house of the father, and it's the heart. You know?
It's the heart, and it's all about children.
And it's... Yes. Yes, right. Yeah. Yes. And now we are talking about the children of the new age. And yeah, that's a whole nother thing, that age of Aquarius. So, Kathy, do you have anything that you want to share before we do this?
No, my dear. I'm just hanging in and enjoying the conversation.
Okay. I was just, maybe I'll read this one little section. The temperatures at the North Pole are pushed above freezing today thanks to a freak storm, the same storm that caused disastrous flooding in the Midwest. Tornado outbreaks in the southern United States. Today's temperatures, this was on Wednesday, yesterday, at the North Pole were 50 degrees higher than average for this time of year. It was so warm the North Pole, at least for a while today, was the same temperature as Chicago and warmer than any other United States cities. Mm-hmm. Finally, we end in Canada with a big discovery at a getaway
spa called Little Manitou Lake, a salt lake that is Canada's version of the Dead Sea. Canadian ministers say they have learned that the lake and the salt lakes like it play a valuable role in the environment by absorbing atmospheric carbon more efficiently than our oceans do and our forests do. The reporter says they call this the Dead Sea of Canada, Little Manitou Lake. It is so salty that only microscopic creatures can live in it. Rivers flow in, yet not out. Evaporation makes it even saltier. Farmers have long known not to plant crops on the shore, yet there is a spa like the real Dead Sea, and it's been there. It's been here for decades. Now, the Dead Sea is evaporating, too, very, very rapidly. It's going away. And then this reporter said, in the 20s and the 30s, the people came from all over to visit the Manitou Lake, and they came and healed the in the water. They bathed in the water, and they put the mud on themselves for exfoliants, and it was very much a health place. Saltwater lakes are well known in this part of the world. And aside from this, let me turn the page, everybody. One where tourism and taking the waters has been popular for decades. They are seen as somewhat of a nuisance. Yet new research is showing that a lake like this with its saline waters may actually be performing a very valuable service. Researchers at the University of Regina say that since such alkaline lakes, and there are hundreds of them here in Manitoba, they absorb atmospheric carbon. Their complex chemistry stores the carbon in mud as a stable element, more than a million tons a year, up to a third of the vast CO2 output of Saskatchewan's farms. Oh, this is in Saskatchewan. I'm sorry. Got the wrong province there. Okay, best of all, it's an entirely natural process. We don't have to do anything other than just make sure that we don't drain them. I think lakes have really been underappreciated in the carbon budget just because total surface area relative to oceans and forests, they are not huge. Yet the rates at which they are processing carbon is far, far faster than, say, the open ocean. And that was spoken by Carrie Finley, from a professor at the University of Regina, on these subjects. As oceans become more acidic, they sop up much less carbon than normal. And that's what we just said, that they're way more acidic now and warmer. And then the fish can't, you know, we go up 1 degree and the fish don't live. These bodies of water, and neither do the coral, you know, these bodies of water are crucial then, and not just here. The Caspian Sea, the largest salty lake in the world, has similar chemistry. Environmental archivists say this is exactly the kind of science that should transform our approach to the world's carbon problem. We need good applied science to figure out how we actually achieve this. Yeah, as we can use the applied science to set out what we need to achieve, then we can hand over to the economists and the social scientists to figure out the details of how we get there. So far, the governments aren't doing much with this research, yet there's excitement building over how it might be applied as Canada ever draws up a plan to deal with the emissions and atmospheric carbon, and the salt lakes of the North American prairies could just be part of it. That's the end of that little piece.
Let me interrupt you here just a moment. From Commander Randy has asked a question of Rama. If you could answer to the internet chatter that something's going to happen during 2016 that will keep Obama in power.
I could just say,
well,
it has to do with full disclosure.
Yes, it does. It also, I mean, also, you know, I said this before, Grand Goddess Lily is a very intuitive person, and I asked her, you know, what do you see about the next presidency? And she said, well, for sure, I don't see Obama leaving the presidential seat. And so, and what we know is Michelle Obama is on the ticket, and Bernie Sanders knows it too. And we said this before, just to remind everybody, but Oprah Winfrey in her home in Costa Rica had Bernie Sanders and Randy Rhodes and Elizabeth Warren and by long distance phone Michelle Obama, and they did a powwow about how to form this movement and who can do it while things still look like they do, because Michelle can't engage at this time. And then it will be changing, and it will become a more natural thing for her, and a divine feminine that's really divine. And as I said, that these things about what's really, you know, behind the Bush, I mean, the Clintons and the, and also there's some lawsuits now with the Center for Constitutional Rights that's going to take these Bushes right out of here too. They've got some really heavy indictments now. And Bush Jr. was invited to give a talk somewhere in Europe, and we think he canceled it because he's scared to go out there because the extraditions. There's a noose around these guys' necks, and we're not going to play it tonight, but just go ahead and check out, if you want to do a little early checkout, check out Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert's New Year's Eve report. They have a guest on there that's walking this one right through what the banksters are getting away
Debt
with this.
Debt Jubilee,
and these guys are not going to get away with this. And it's you know, this is where we take it deeper. We still chop wood, carry water, even though it doesn't look like most people are even seeing the lay of the land, and most people are still thinking at another level. Yet, as we stay strong, like Margaret Mead said, you know, a small group of us, indeed, the only thing that's ever changed the world is that small group, and actually becoming that unity consciousness together with these ideas. So I don't know if that helps you, Commander Randy, but the Divine Feminine, if you haven't seen that Star Wars movie, go see it.
Oh my God.
And we also got a hint that it looks like Han Solo dies, but he doesn't.
That's
it looks like that. And it's
go see the movie.
It's just like Lord of the Rings. Looks like the good wizard dies, but he doesn't.
No.
And that's the same thing going on here. And the Divine Feminine is taking us over that rainbow bridge. It's pretty, the symbolism and the depth of it is really, really worth, we got to go see it again.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be more, and there's some other series, like we're looking for the symbol. That's what it's called. The third,
Lost Symbol.
The Lost Symbol, which is the third book in that series of the Da Vinci Code, and then the Angels and the Demons, and now this one, The Lost Symbol. That's going to start moving, and then the Golden Compass has some follow-ups too. I heard that there's some things that take twists that aren't so cool in the book, but yeah. They're going to do that transformative thing with all of this stuff. And this has all come about. So let's do this. And we better stop talking now. It's 8:18. We'll see if we can finish this piece. But this is a serious but educational piece. So I hope this will be of advantage to everybody.
Okay, so we're going to change the, well, let's see, what's it called here? I'm just going to go to the page here. One second. It's called Plutocracy. This part focuses on the ways in which the American people have historically been divided so that we can know that and change it. So it's called Plutocracy 1, Divide et Impera. Here we go. Okay, Rama, can you move over the, on the other side so I can... Yeah. Okay, so here we... just tell them the first 4 minutes we missed, but that won't have any trouble. Just tell them that, Rama.
The first 4 minutes we missed, but you'll get it.
Yeah, pull that out some more, away from the speakers. Thanks. Okay.
There are a number of perpetrators.
The Baldwin Felts Detective Agency had become notorious throughout the region for using violence to prevent union organizing. 300 private detectives arrived and began evicting families from their homes, forcing the miners to set up a tent colony at Holly Grove. In July, the Irish immigrant and labor activist Mother Jones arrived to show her support. Jones had been declared the most dangerous woman in America due to her success in organizing workers. A decade earlier, she led a children's march from Philadelphia to the hometown of President Theodore Roosevelt, demanding an end to child labor. In Kanawha County, Jones persuaded more workers to join the strike. Along with Frank Keeney of the United Mine Workers, she then arranged a march of 3,000 miners to the state capitol in Charleston, where she read the Declaration of Independence. The miners saw themselves as industrial slaves, and they were ready to rebel against their masters. On July 26th, strikers attacked Baldwin Felt's agents in the town of Mukla. 4 guards and 12 strikers were killed. The state government declared martial law. Attacks against miners in Kanawha by both police and private security forces were routine and often deadly. In February, a posse led by the local sheriff, Bonner Hill, drove a heavily armored train nicknamed the Bull Moose Special toward the tent colony at Holly Grove, then opened fire with a machine gun. One man was killed and over a dozen wounded. A few days later, another police raid killed several men. Mother Jones was arrested on February 13th and charged in military court. Refusing to recognize the court's jurisdiction, she was convicted of incitement to riot and conspiracy to commit murder. Her sentence, 20 years in the state penitentiary. As winter set in, conditions in the tent colony grew increasingly dire. At least a dozen men died from starvation. In March, West Virginians elected a new governor. He took a more conciliatory approach, freeing 30 miners held under martial law statutes and transferring Mother Jones to Charleston for medical treatment. She was released after 85 days. The strikers were forced to accept a settlement under threat of deportation from the state. Some workers continued to fight for another 6 months. According to a later study by the Senate's Committee on Education and Labor, about 50 violent deaths had occurred during the Paint Cabin Creek strike, mostly workers. Yet no reforms resulted. Even as the mining of coal drove the American economy to new heights, the men and boys who removed it from the ground were considered expendable. Similar events would take place 8 years later when striking miners in Miquon, West Virginia, were subjected to a series of assaults by Baldwin Felt detectives employed by the Stone Mountain Company. Workers and their families were evicted from their homes, while union organizers were blacklisted and beaten. Events came to a head when Miquon's police chief, Sid Hatfield, made the rare move of siding with the workers against the company. A gunfight broke out, killing 7 detectives and 3 townsmen. Dynamiting a coal tipple, an allegation most miners considered fraudulent. As he ascended the courthouse steps with his deputy, Ed Chambers, both men were gunned down in cold blood. At the time, the United Mine Workers were facing setbacks. Though they had successfully organized much of West Virginia, the southern coal fields remained entirely in the control of corporations. 80% of mines in the area had reopened due to the importing of replacement workers, commonly called scabs, while returning strikers were required to sign so-called yellow dog contracts, agreements in which workers pledged not to join a union. A coal company lawyer, S.B. Avis, explained the concerns of management. It is like a servant lives at your house. If the servant leaves your employment, if you discharge him, you ask him to get out of the servant's quarters. It is a question of master and servant. Evicted from their homes, miners set up tent colonies and began a campaign of guerrilla warfare, engaging in skirmishes up and down the Tug Fork River. Casualties resulted on both sides. In May, the government declared martial law, but the legislation was unequally enforced. Workers were the primary target, with hundreds arrested and denied habeas corpus rights. When Sid Hatfield was shot, the miners decided that they had had enough. Men along the Little Coal River were the first to militarize, setting up guard posts and patrols. Meanwhile, word of the unlawful executions was spreading. In a matter of days, some 12,000 coal miners took up arms and began planning a march on Logan and Mingo counties. The goal was to free imprisoned workers, end martial law, and organize the entire region. Standing in the way was Blair Mountain, a 2,000-foot natural impediment occupied by the National Guard. The war was defined by class. Most lower-class workers supported the insurrection. In contrast, Logan County Sheriff Don Chaffin made an appeal to business owners. Americans should do their patriotic duty, he claimed, by opposing the workers and preventing mob rule. Chaffin's salary was partly subsidized by the coal companies. The miners wore red bandanas, earning them the nickname Rednecks. It was the largest armed uprising in the United States since the Civil War. Thank you. forces were heavily armed with cutting-edge munitions, including machine guns and even planes, which were used to drop homemade chemical weapons and shrapnel bombs on the Redneck Army. At one point, bombers from Maryland were flown in to perform aerial surveillance. Despite their superior weaponry and despite their superior tactical position, the National Guard was outnumbered 3-1. Equally important, the rebels had extensive knowledge of the terrain. While the guardsmen felled trees and dug trenches, the miners made use of natural pathways, rapidly ascending the mountain. According to archaeologist Harvard Ayers, who made an extensive study of Blair Mountain artifacts, the Redneck Army would almost certainly have won the battle. But the coal companies had a trump card. September 1st, 1921, President Warren G. Harding sent in federal troops from Fort Thomas, Kentucky. The miners, many of whom had fought in World War I, refused to engage American soldiers. Many even celebrated their arrival, regarding them as comrades in arms. But their trust was misplaced. After surrendering, 1,217 indictments were laid down, including 325 for murder and 24 for treason. It is likely that many of the miners would have been executed, but the public was sympathetic to their plight. Of the men convicted, most only served a few years in prison. Bill Blizzard, who was regarded by authorities as the general of the miners' army, was first tried at the Jefferson County Courthouse in Charlestown, the same building in which John Brown had been tried for treason in 1859. Brown had led a failed revolt against the institution of slavery in the United States and was subsequently hanged. Blizzard, though tried several times in several different locations, was eventually acquitted. The West Virginian Mine Wars were part of a broader conflict between the forces of labor and the forces of capital, a struggle that claimed the lives of thousands of American workers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Thousands more were beaten, maimed, imprisoned, tortured, and sent to early graves due to poor working conditions and dismal safety standards. According to historian Philip Taft, the United States, during this time period, was home of the bloodiest and most violent labor history of any industrial nation in the world. The American state is born of a rebellion, but not the one American children are taught about in school. In 1786, 1 year before the Constitutional Convention, farmers in Western Massachusetts organized a resistance movement against the state legislature in Boston. Most of the men were veterans of the Revolutionary War. Heavily indebted, overtaxed, and facing foreclosures of their homes and farms, they petitioned their government for redress. No help was forthcoming. Wealth inequality in the United States had been steadily increasing over the past century. In 1687 Boston, the top 1% owned 25% of the wealth. By 1770, that number had risen to 44%. During the same time period, the number of people who owned no property increased from 14% to 29%. The leader of the revolt was Daniel Shays. He served as a captain in the Continental Army and fought at the Battle of Lexington. Under his leadership, rebels in Massachusetts forcefully closed lawyers and liberated imprisoned debtors from jail. Governor James Bowdoin responded by organizing a state militia funded by wealthy merchants. The rebellion was crushed, but its legacy was profound.
The United States Constitution was written by men, primarily propertied men, and primarily men who were very concerned by the threats to private property and to their own wealth and income and power that were occurring all over the colonies in the 18th century. You didn't have a strong central government. The states were actually sovereign entities, pretty much independent of one another. And some states would do this and other states would do that. You didn't have any power in the Articles of Confederation to deal with commerce. There was no executive branch. There was no central power. The states were really independent sovereignties, and they pretty much went their own way depending on the influence and the power of the particular interests and people in the power structure in the individual states. So the problem came to a head in 1786, 1787. People were rising up and protesting the fact that they were being exploited, that they were not living anything like a decent existence. They were being, they felt ripped off by courts and by banks and by the then existing power structure. These farmers, many of whom had been members of the Revolutionary Army, having fought off England, felt they deserved a somewhat better shake than they were getting. The state militia was called in and put it down bloodily. The problem, from the point of view of the founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, was that this was not happening just in western Massachusetts. It was happening in places like Rhode Island and in Virginia as well. There was no central authority to organize the reaction to the kinds of things that were going on. This was a clear and present danger as perceived by George Washington, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and a lot of other very wealthy, very powerful, very elite men. There was a call for a meeting in 1786, which led to another call for a meeting in 1787. And various states sent delegates to that meeting in Philadelphia. And the first thing they did was close the doors. They didn't want any, you know, reporters reporting on their daily discussions. So they closed the doors and they junked the Articles of Confederation completely. They were only authorized to revise the Articles of Confederation by the state's delegations that they represented. Some of the southern states were dependent on slavery for their essential existence and for their workforce. So abolishing slavery did not happen in Philadelphia in 1787. Madison, of course, was a slave owner. Jefferson was a slave owner. Washington was a slave owner. Some people wanted to abolish slavery right out. There were lots of pressures going on in Europe and elsewhere for simply the abolishment of slavery. So what they did was they didn't abolish slavery, but they set a 20-year limit on it. And after 20 years, the slave trade in the United States would be stopped. There would be no more commerce in slaves. But the slaves that were there would, of course, reproduce, and the kids would still be slaves. But there wouldn't be the odious slave markets. So that was a bow in the direction of lessening the tight hold of the slave South on the country as a whole. What happened was they allowed the famous Three-Fifth Compromise. States which had large numbers of slaves and depended on those slaves for their labor force, those states would, for purposes of representation in the House of Representatives, slaves would be counted as three-fifths of a person. So slaves were credited politically in establishing the population and the membership in the Southern society, but only a three-fifths of a person. One of the key people in the effort at ratification was Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton dreamt up the idea of publishing a series of papers, and he got James Madison and he got John Jay, who was the first Chief Justice of the United States under the new Constitution, to add their names to his effort. And they published a series of papers which became famous as the Federalist Papers. Although Hamilton did participate in the convention, he had relatively little influence there. He had a lot of influence later in passage of the Constitution in New York. But his views were so to the right of everybody else's and so elitist. You know, he sort of like represented Wall Street before there was a Wall Street. The key guy at the convention was really James Madison. He wrote for Hamilton's Federalist Papers. And one of the papers that Madison authored was Federalist Number 10. Madison's Federalist 10 was a very short essay, appeared in a newspaper, in which he basically outlined the philosophical context, the theoretical context, within which the Constitution was adopted, and within which the subsequent U.S. government would perform its governmental activities. In Federalist 10, Madison defined the problem that they faced in Philadelphia as, how do we deal with the problem of factions? The idea of factions was that there were all these different social groupings in the country, and you could have in the country people with a class interest organizing and taking power, and you wanted to structure the system then against the possibility that they might be able to pull that off. Especially the faction that he was worried about there was the majority faction. The essence of the majority faction would be a populistic power center. If too much power were placed in the hands of the people in a democratic society, that was a danger. If too much power was in the hands of the rich and powerful in a less democratic or non-democratic society, that was equally a problem to be dealt with. If you want to understand the U.S. Constitution, I think you have to put it in the context of the class struggle that was going on in these states at this time. If you read the discussions and the notes, especially at Madison's, it's quite clear what they felt and what they thought. Madison saw the new country as highly turbulent, full of conflicts, and he argued that the United States, perhaps they didn't have the extremes of wealth and poverty found in Europe, but in all civilized countries, he argued, and I'm quoting here, the people fall into different classes having a real or supposed difference of interest. There are creditors, he said, debtors, farmers, merchants, and manufacturers. There are, he continued, in particularly, the distinction of rich and poor. In the future, Madison said, there will be even greater inequality. An increase of population will of necessity increase the proportion of those who will labor under all the hardships of life and secretly sigh for a more equal distribution of its blessings. In what clearer statement could you have of a class conflict model and understanding of the world in which he lived? One of the reasons Jefferson bought the middle part of the continent, the Louisiana Purchase, was that whites would have property and land to go and establish themselves as independent producers, not people who worked for the power of capital, not people whose livelihood depended on the powerful and the rich, but who were themselves sort of artisans, sort of independent producers who weren't working for someone else, whose labor was not producing profits for someone else, but profits for themselves and their families. The federal government gave them land tremendously at the expense and detriment of the Indians who lived there in a completely different and in many ways superior society. The Indians, of course, did not see property as something to exploit and own, but something to work and produce and distribute for people who needed it on the basis of their need and on the basis of what they could to do to increase and contribute. Madison knew that the agrarian American dream of Thomas Jefferson was not going to be replicated in the 19th century. He saw industrial capitalism coming here as well as it had been advanced even farther along in England and in European countries. And he basically, I think, didn't have an answer to how he stopped industrial capitalism from displacing not only slavery, which it did, but the whole idea of a democratic republic of relatively equal people in which there is not a hideously uneven distribution of wealth and income and power. But that, in fact, if that happened, this republican experiment of theirs would die.
Terms of surrender to the Union Army. The event marks the end of the American Civil War, the bloodiest internal conflict in U.S. history. During the previous 4 years, 625,000 soldiers perished, and much of the South's infrastructure lies in ruins. As in all wars, the poor had performed the lion's share of the fighting and dying. Billionaire steel magnate Andrew Carnegie paid a poor man to fight on his behalf, as did J.P. Morgan, Jay Gould, and John D. Rockefeller. Their abdication was made possible by the Conscription Enrollment Act of 1863, which allowed the rich to avoid military service for a cash payment of $300. James Mellon's father wrote to his son, "A man may be a patriot without risking his own life or sacrificing his health. There are plenty of lives less valuable." The ability of the wealthy to buy their way out of military service caused rage amongst the poor, leading to draft riots in some cities. Most dramatic was the New York riot of 1863, which resulted in the deaths of 2,000 protesters and the wounding of another 8,000. While government officials and the wealthy were targeted during the riot, so too were African Americans. Rioters set fire to the colored orphans' asylum, burning it to the ground. A 9-year-old black boy was attacked and killed at the corner of Broadway and Chambers. And several black men were lynched, their bodies mutilated and set on fire. Though racism was prominent amongst all ethnicities, anti-black sentiment was especially pronounced in the Irish-American community, despite, or perhaps because of, parallel forms of discrimination faced by both groups. From the beginnings of the colonial era, Irish immigrants had existed at the very bottom of white society. Hundreds of thousands of Irish people had been forced into indentured servitude, and though this practice was eventually eliminated, the Irish continued to face violent repression in their native land. In the mid-19th century, they arrived in the New World, unskilled and desperate for work. Brutal poverty became the norm. One study estimated that 80% of babies born to 19th century Irish immigrants in New York died while in infancy. Irish women mostly worked as servants or prostitutes, while males were stereotyped as violent criminals. The term paddy wagon, slang for police car, derives from the ethnic slur paddy, which in turn derives from the common Irish name Patrick. Irish immigrants were mocked for their accents, their religion, and their overall impoverishment. They were also amongst the first ethnic groups in the United States to form labor unions. Eventually, business owners began placing signs in their windows reading NINA, No Irish Need Apply. In the South, Irish immigrants became known as white Negroes. Slaves were considered valuable property and were prevented from engaging in dangerous work. As a result, the most perilous jobs were left to the Irish. One businessman explained, "Negroes are worth too much to be risked here. If the paddies are knocked overboard, nobody loses anything." Thousands of Irish immigrants died during the building of the nation's canals and railroads. The great American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, became especially attuned to conflicts between Irish and African Americans. Douglass had been able to purchase his freedom in large part due to donations by citizens in Ireland, which he visited during the potato famine in 1845. The Irish saw in the American slave a corollary to their own degraded condition and were strongly supportive of the abolitionist movement. In the United States itself, it was a different story. Douglass wrote, "The Irish, who at home readily sympathize with the oppressed everywhere, are instantly taught, when they step upon our soil, to hate and despise the Negro. The cruel lies told them that we deprive them of labor and receive the money that would otherwise make its way into their pockets." Yet the competition created by employers was real. African Americans were often forced into conflict with low-status white immigrants for work and were sometimes used as strikebreakers. Only 4 months before the draft riot, black workers were used to derail a strike of mostly Irish longshoremen on the docks of New York. A major theme in the propaganda against the abolitionist movement was that free black men would depress the wages of white workers. In 1860, General Leslie Combs warned at a Democratic meeting, "The unemployed slaves will be found among you in sufficient numbers to compete with you at your wharves and your docks, and in every branch of labor in which white people alone are now employed." Following the Civil War, whites of all ethnicities were encouraged by Southern elites to unite against Reconstruction, the inspiring but failed attempt by African Americans to achieve social, economic, and political equality in the South.
The Reconstruction period is little understood. It's a moment when something big happened that we usually only remember for the bad things that happened afterwards. We know that it turned out badly, that black people were defeated, that there was the Klan and lynching and their rights were taken away, and we ended up with Jim Crow, segregation, and terrorism. What we tend to appreciate less in America's classrooms is that brief moment in the sun when new things genuinely became possible. when the Civil War concluded, the slaves were freed by their own effort. They had shot their way to freedom. They had joined the Union Army in enormous numbers. They had run away and lent their services to the Union Army. They had withdrawn their labor from the southern plantations. And they had made the crucial difference to conclude the war. They turned it into a revolutionary war for emancipation. We could just imagine the tremendous confidence that they gained at a moment like that. Once they concluded that struggle and were free, then of course the last thing they wanted was to return to that same slave-like condition. And so they did many, many things to transform their circumstances. They tried to seize land and the land of their former masters and work it for themselves. They tried to build schools, and they did build schools. In fact, they built the first public schools in the South. They, with the help of Northern troops who had occupied the South, totally reconstructed social life. Black people not only served on juries, which was unheard of, they served as judges. And you have cases of white people coming before a black judge to try to get justice. It took 100 years for as many black people to be elected to Congress as we had elected in Congress during Reconstruction, elected to Congress. So there was something radical that was going on. The world was turned upside down. And this is the same period as the Paris Commune, the time when working people in the city of Paris tried to take over the city and run it for themselves and formed a commune. That coincidence, the idea that the people on the bottom were now suddenly on top, and that they had made all kinds of alliances with poor white people and were setting up public schools, public hospitals, facilities for poor people generally, not just for black people. I think it sent a tremor of terror through the American ruling class. Something's wrong here. The real problem is that the Northern ruling class, the industrialists of the North, were not consistent allies for black liberation. First of all, they didn't fight the Civil War in order to free slaves. They fought the Civil War to save the Union. Once the slave owners' rebellion was put down, they lost interest in the project of black rights and social equality. They also lost interest in land reform. Giving land, 40 acres and a mule, to freed people, only to the radical Republicans did that seem like justice. To the Northern industrialists, now they wanted to get on with the business of remaking the South in their own image, and that meant making money. And that meant also that the former slaves had to get back to work. They had to get back to work producing those very lucrative and valuable commodities like cotton that they were producing before. And so the struggle to get the former freed people back to work as wage workers, the very thing they really did not want to be. They wanted to be independent and own land, is the fact that they lost their former allies. The political alliance that they made with poor whites and their collective struggle and organization was not strong enough to withstand the new ruling class offensive once the Northern troops withdrew their forces. The compromise between the Northern and Southern elites was essentially like, okay, you can get back to business now. We'll withdraw our troops and let's get on with it now that struggle is over. And unfortunately, that left black people high and dry. But if we skip over that moment, that window when new things were possible, new possibilities were opened up, then we miss what all the struggle was about. Why do you have to have the Klan? Why do you have to terrorize people? Why do you have to murder people who are trying to vote? It's important to understand how much of a threat this new reconstructed order, what Du Bois calls black reconstruction, how much of a threat that was, that threatened to become a kind of working class democracy.
New laws known as black codes were passed throughout the South. In Mississippi, blacks could be arrested if they left a job before the end of a contract. In South Carolina, a law prohibited black people from holding any occupation other than farmer or servant unless they paid an annual tax. some states limited the type of property blacks could own and allowed employers to whip them. Jim Crow laws enforced segregation and curtailed African American voting rights. During the same time period, poor white voters were also disenfranchised. When Mississippi passed a new poll tax, the number of qualified white voters fell from 130,000 to 68,000. An editorial in the Charlotte Observer praised the disenfranchisement of both black and poor white voters in North Carolina as the struggle of the white people to rid themselves of the dangers of the rule of Negroes and the lower class of whites. Reconstruction was a coalition of elite Democrats known as the Redeemers, wealthy businessmen and landowners who attempted to maintain the conditions of slavery in all but name. In the words of historian C. Van Woodward, the Redeemers frankly constituted themselves as champions of the property owner against the propertyless and allegedly untaxed masses. Between the years 1882 and 1930, a black man was lynched or legally executed in the United States every 4 days. A study by Stuart Tolney and E. Beck demonstrated that these lynchings tended to follow economic cycles, with blacks safer from mob violence when the profits were high. According to historian Robert N. Grando, not infrequently, the mob was encouraged or led by people prominent in the area's political and business circles. The racially targeted violence of the Klan and other vigilante groups was not limited to blacks. In the Southwest, interracial violence was a routine occurrence between whites, Native Americans, Hispanics, and Mexican Americans. The sheer number of European immigrants expanding westward sealed the fate of the land's original inhabitants. In California, a genocidal campaign had reduced the indigenous population from 150,000 in 1846 to 30,000 by 1870. Sacramento Union newspaper reported in 1862, the baby hunters sneak up to a rancheria, kill the bucks, pick up the best-looking squaws, ravish them, and make off with their young ones. As the Indian population was decimated, and as new borders were charted in the wake of the Mexican-American War, nine whites found themselves labeled aliens in their own ancestral lands.
Mexico was first presaged by efforts to acquire northern regions of Mexico nonviolently, first through purchase, but when that failed, the architects of westward expansion engineered a war that ultimately allowed for the U.S. to occupy strategic points of Mexico, including Los Angeles, San Diego, New Mexico, and Arizona. After the cessation of the war, the United States acquired what is today the Southwest with the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, which compelled Mexico to forfeit its northern half of the country, and with it, tens of thousands of Mexicans who now lived in a land that they had always lived in but was now part of a foreign country. Within a short period of time, the incoming Anglo-American population quickly outnumbered the Mexican population and began to construct a legal regime to displace the landowning Mexican population and to reduce the rest of the population to labor in the new industrial firms, agriculture, railroads, mining, etc. on the heels of the failure of Reconstruction and the creation of Jim Crow, these techniques of racially segregating a population were applied throughout the Southwest, and Mexicans quickly found themselves not only dispossessed of their land, but limited as to where they could live, where they could work, what social spaces they could even travel through. Even though the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo guaranteed that they would have a path to citizenship and would enjoy equality under the law, they found themselves legislatively constructed as a foreign people, as a people with little rights, as a people in some parts of the Southwest who couldn't own land, who couldn't work in certain types of jobs, who couldn't intermarry or intermix with the European American population, and ultimately relegated to a second class of citizenship, much in the way that African Americans were in the U.S. South.
Slave has taken from his by indirection what the black slave has taken from him directly.
A time of incredible transformation, rapid industrialization, hothouse economic growth. Every decade in the late 19th century saw either an acute recession or a major depression, throwing thousands, if not millions, of people out of work, pushing businesses into bankruptcy. All of this was an incredible challenge for working people. On the eve of the Civil War, the United States was predominantly an agricultural nation. By the turn of the 20th century, it was the number one industrial power in the world. So what for working men and women and children was, as they faced proletarianization, as they faced the rise of corporate capitalism, powerful corporations sometimes exercising a tyrannical impact on their lives, it meant that they had very little chance at achieving the economic independence they had come to expect. As corporations grew so powerful in the late 19th century, inequality radically increased. Henry George said, memorably, the tramp comes along with the locomotive. The prison, the almshouse, comes along with mansions.
Free Speech TV. Historically, the American people have been divided on the basis of race, ethnicity, sex, and class. Our history classes barely taught us about labor movements and the everyday people who stood up to the wealthy elite and corporations, but instead focused on teaching us about the very people in power, the general presidents, heads of corporations that dominated society. In 1888, President Hayes wrote in his diary that the United States was becoming a government of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation. His entry speaks to the reality we're living on a much larger scale today. For 20 years, Free Speech TV has been independent from billionaires, governments, and corporations.
companies were established in all of the major industries. The names remain familiar. John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil. Cornelius Vanderbilt's Central Railroad. Andrew Carnegie's Carnegie Steel. J.P. Morgan's Banking House. The robber barons portrayed themselves as virtuous high flyers in a fair, free market economy. Many even told stories of previous poverty, and in a few instances were telling the truth. Yet a study of 303 textile, railroad, and steel executives from the 1870s revealed that 90% had come from middle-class or upper-class families. While publicly singing the praises of laissez-faire capitalism, the robber barons took every opportunity to bribe politicians and crush their competitors. Payoffs became so expensive that some industrialists established bribe caps, a variant on price fixing. During the 1870s, when Jay Gould and Cornelius Vanderbilt competed over control of the Erie Railroad, they held a meeting in New York where they negotiated a ceiling for bribing politicians. By the late 19th century, American corporations had become so powerful that even some members of the ruling class expressed concern. In 1888, President Rutherford B. Hayes wrote in his diary that the United States was becoming a government of the corporation, by the corporation, and for the corporation. In public discourse, Congress became known as the Millionaires' Club. Referred to a new Gilded Age in contrast to the Golden Age. 1990, U.S. Army soldiers slaughtered 300 men, women, and children on the Lakota Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. By the same date, nearly all of the buffalo on the North American continent had disappeared. The Army and Navy Register reported after the massacre at Wounded Knee that the red savage is pretty well subdued, but there are white savages growing more numerous and dangerous as our great cities become greater. Ignored by the political class, poor Americans banded together to survive.
American workers were profoundly influenced by small R Republicanist ideas, ideas that the most valued citizen in America is the honest producer, the idea that labor creates all wealth, the idea that citizens should be equal, the idea that they should expect to achieve some degree of economic independence. This meant, in turn, massive protests rocking the United States in the late 19th century as working people and indeed as entire communities rose up in protest against what they saw as injustice. There were no minimum wage laws or maximum hour laws. Economic insecurity became an important part of their lives. In order to survive, they needed to rely on a family economy so that not only would the men go out to work, but women would take in work often, do laundry, take in boarders, or increasingly go out to factories looking for work. It meant that even children needed to be economically productive. Increasingly, children were going into factories to work. Child labor became a huge issue. The number of children under the age of 16 roughly doubled. By 1900, something like 20% of all American workers were under the age of 18.
I first started to work as a breaker when I was 12 years old. Well, what a place. You sat on a hard seat. You didn't dare cushion it nowhere. No matter how much you, what you had, you wouldn't. You have to sit on that plain plank with your feet in a chute and bend over like this, throwing the rock out. A man who's known as the sled boss walked around with a broom, shovel a broom. He'd look behind you. If you let any rock go by, you got a poke or a sock across the back. Well, I'll tell you, it was very scary, believe me. You didn't dare say anything. You didn't dare quit because it was something to have a job. If 8 cents an hour. Your fingernails, you had none. The ends of them would be bleeding every day you come from work. So we fashioned out amongst ourselves, us boys, got old electric wire, you know, burnt the insulation off and got fashioned a little stick, twisted around, made a finger, and then used to slide them over at least 2 fingers on each hand. And I'm telling you, it was a living hell.
For workers, both adults and children, life was increasingly defined by machines. And political systems also took on a mechanistic aspect. The term political machines was used to describe the systems of patronage, graft, hierarchy, and corruption that defined local governance. Elections were controlled by a new phenomenon in the American experience: metropolitan police.
Thank you. beginning in the 19th century and really going into the first part of the 20th century, local government was largely just an exercise in organized corruption. I mean, it was really government by organized crime. The system in place was political loyalty in exchange for material benefit. And that came almost automatically, you might say mechanically, which hence the name political machines. The idea was that the entire resources of the city government were at the disposal of whatever political party happened to be in power at the moment. And so they would use those resources to reward their supporters and to punish their opponents. The police were very important in the operation of these machines for a number of reasons. One being that police jobs could be used as rewards for supporters of the political party who won the election. So it wasn't unusual to see departments completely emptied out and suffer a complete turnover following an election one way rather than the other. Also, the elections were largely determined by physical control of the polling places. Political parties would mobilize their supporters more or less as rival gangs and literally fight for control of polling places. Of course, the police were instrumental in making sure that these fights went one way rather than the other, and then also had responsibility for, you know, regulating the polls, and then in many places for transporting the ballots and some places for counting the ballots. So they could suppress the votes of the opposition party and inflate the votes of the party that was in power. So really this worked as kind of a protection racket. And when I talk about political support, I don't just mean support in the sense of mobilizing votes and expressing sympathy and that kind of thing. I also mean support in financial terms. Businesses, prominent citizens, that sort of thing, were expected to financially contribute to the funds of the machine that they supported. The ones that did would receive police protection. The ones that didn't would receive police harassment. This was especially important in terms of illegal businesses. So illegal saloons, brothels, that sort of thing, if they supported the party in power, could expect police protection. And in fact, in many cities, the police would be responsible for collecting the bribes. If they did not, they could expect that the law would be enforced and they would see their business shut down. This arrangement continued in most American cities well into the 20th century.
In addition to providing protection rackets for organized crime and determining the outcome of elections, police were also used to discipline the working class. In Tompkins Square, New York, 1874, 7,000 workers protested unemployment, only to be savagely attacked by police. In the words of Samuel Gompers, who went on to lead the American Federation of Labor, mounted police charged the crowd on 8th Street, riding them down and attacking men, women, and children without discrimination. It was an orgy of brutality. A few years earlier, common experiences between workers at the hands of police, politicians, and employers had given rise to the first major attempt at unionization in the United States. Aristocracy of labor, the the common tendency of trade unions to exclude members according to skill level. Tongues firmly in cheek, they excluded bankers, lawyers, liquor manufacturers, and stockholders, whom they labeled unproductive members of society. Despite the Knights' promotion of working class unity, the entrenched racism of American society made progress difficult. Attempts to unionize black workers in the South often ended in violence. In 1886, the Knights tried to organize African American workers in the Southern sugar fields. At Thibodaux, Louisiana, martial law was declared. Two black union organizers, Henry and George Cox, were arrested and never heard from again. The next day, 20 other black union members were found dead. In response to the massacre, an editorial in an African American newspaper reported, "To even think that such disregard for human life is permitted in this portion of the United States makes one question whether or not the Civil War was a failure." Though the Knights achieved some victories, they were ill-prepared for the massive task of organizing 750,000 people. Shortly after their founding, they were replaced by the more exclusionary American Federation of Labor, as well as a diffuse network of smaller, less powerful unions. When the Knights were still gaining in influence, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 demonstrated the ability of ordinary workers to coalesce into a powerful nationwide force.
In the 1870s, as the United States was still recovering from Civil War and Reconstruction and industrialization is rapidly taking off, the United States is hit by a depression, 1873 to 1877. Businesses are going bankrupt. Employers trying to survive are laying off workers or slashing wages. Workers begin protesting the wage cuts, which are happening repeatedly. On the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, for example, railroad workers had already, by 1877, confronted three different wage cuts. They go on strike in Martinsburg, West Virginia, refuse to let trains pass until the wage cut is revoked. And this strike quickly spreads. Often it's referred to as the insurrection of 1877. It's really the first major uprising against the new capitalist order. The strike spreads from Virginia to Baltimore, and then west through Pennsylvania to Illinois to Missouri. One of the striking things about this upheaval is that it's not just the railroad workers. Whole communities come out to support the striking railroad workers. So families, women, and children. They're saying, this is our community. We built this, and it shouldn't be left to a few railroad owners to dictate to us. In some cities, in Chicago and St. Louis, the strike flowers into an all-out general strike, paralyzing the entire cities for days. So as this is happening, as protest is spreading, as the strike is spreading, the governments at the city and state and federal level are figuring out what to do. They send in some cases, state militias. In some cases, the militias refuse to restore order, refuse to fire on the strikers. In Pittsburgh, militiamen bayonet and shoot strikers, killing 20 of them. In protest, the strikers then destroy several buildings and more than 100 train cars and locomotives. So in several cases, order is not restored until the president sends in federal troops. In fact, order is restored in part because the president takes troops. This is a signal moment in U.S. history, I think. The president orders troops out of the South, where they had been protecting the rights of freed men and women, and orders them north to put down working class insurrection. And with that, you can kind of see symbolically the shift in U.S. history from a moment that was about empowering freed slaves, shifting to a moment to repress the rights of working class men and women. We see it as really the first great protest against the new industrial order. And also in its aftermath, governments across the country take action to build urban armories and forts so that the next time a working class uprising occurs, the government will be able to use troops more easily to suppress them.
Although the great upheaval was defeated, it wasn't a total loss. Workers in many areas received increased wages and improved working conditions. More importantly, the event realized the concept of class struggle in the minds of the poor. During the strike, workers complained that they were treated just as the rolling stock of locomotives. In Baltimore, a striker remarked on class solidarity, "The working people everywhere are with us. They know what it is like to bring up a family on 90 cents a day. Barely able to survive after endless toil, workers increasingly looked at the philosophies of socialism, communism, and anarchism. Though socialist literature was often banned from libraries and schools, a spirited labor press emerged in all of the major cities. When a lawyer named Edward Bellamy published a utopian socialist novel titled Looking Backward, it quickly sold over a million copies. Unions around the country were becoming increasingly militant and often resorted to sabotage to prevent strike breaking. In the tradition of the Luddites, they monkey wrenched and destroyed machinery. An account from Atchison, Kansas, provides one example. At 12:45 this morning, 10 men on guard at the Missouri Pacific Roundhouse were surprised by the appearance of 35 or 40 masked men. The guards were corralled in the oil room by a detachment of the visitors, who stood guard with pistols drawn, while the rest of them thoroughly disabled 12 locomotives. Workers across the nation were uniting under the demand of the 8-hour workday. 4,700 workers struck in Boston, 7,000 in Milwaukee, 9,000 in Baltimore, and 32,000 in Cincinnati. In New York, 25,000 union members created a torchlit procession along Broadway. The largest campaign occurred in the industrial epicenter of Chicago, where 40,000 workers went on strike. In 1884, anarchists in Chicago argued for the establishment of a free society based upon cooperative organization of production, organization of education on a secular, scientific, and equal basis for both sexes, and equal rights for all without distinction of sex or race. Other workers joined in. The Chicago cigar makers called for the open rebellion of the robbed class. In 1885, a new central labor union was created, which included metal workers, carpenters, cabinet workers, and butchers. In 1886, a scuffle at a picket line. Police shot and killed several workers outside the McCormick Harvester factory in Chicago, the single largest factory in the country. 1,300 men worked 10-hour shifts, 6 days a week, for non-subsistence wages. Both the mayor and the chief of police routinely received bribes by Cyrus McCormick Jr., the factory's owner. Outraged by the violence, anarchists organized a rally at Haymarket Square. As police charged the protesters, an unknown assailant lobbed a bomb in their direction, killing one officer and fatally wounding another six. The police opened fire.
We still don't know to this day where the bomb came from or who threw it. Policeman was killed. Policeman opened fire, killing several workers and several other policemen. This incident became known as the Haymarket incident. 8 laborers, all of them anarchists, activists, active both in the trade unions and in the anarchist movement, were arrested. Anarchism plays a remarkable role in the late 19th century U.S. It sees state power or centralized power of any kind as fundamentally corrupting, and instead it emphasizes participatory democracy, kind of grassroots ways of organizing oneselves, cooperatives, collaboration at a very grassroots level.
Although the anarchists who'd organized the rally at Haymarket were not linked to the bombing, they were nevertheless arrested and charged with conspiracy. 7 of the men were sentenced to death, and the 8th to 15 years in prison. The trial was widely recognized as a farce. Prior to the arrests, State's Attorney Julius Grinnell publicly recommended to make the raids first and look up the law afterwards. The hand-picked jury consisted of businessmen, their own clerks, and a relative of one of the dead policemen, and they were instructed that anarchy is on trial. Make examples of them, hang them, and save our institutions, our society. Sentenced to death, August Spees delivered a speech before the court. If you think that by hanging us, you can stamp out the labor movement, the movement from which the downtrodden millions, the millions who toil and live in want and misery, the wage slaves, if that is your opinion, then hang us. Here we will tread upon a spark, and behind you and in front of you, flames will blaze up. It is a subterranean fire. The ground is on fire upon which you stand. A year after his trial, August Spees was hanged along with Albert Parsons, Adolf Eicher, and George Engel. Louis Lane committed suicide while in prison to deny the state its power. Were welcomed by Chicago's gentry, international opinion was overwhelmingly negative. From London, the famous playwright George Bernard Shaw remarked, "If the United States must lose 8 men, it could better afford to lose the 8 members of the Illinois Supreme Court."
It was a huge incident in U.S. history, not only for those arrested, but for the entire labor movement, because it led to a powerful backlash against workers and against anyone perceived as being radical and or immigrant. Across the country, workers were fired if they were suspected of being union activists or being radicals. Many workers lost their jobs. Many found it just politically impossible to express radical beliefs freely. And in this environment, the Knights of Labor, which had risen to some 800,000 members in the aftermath of Haymarket. The Knights of Labor membership quickly fell until by 1890. It was nearly a dead organization. At the same time that the Knights of Labor was growing in power in the 1880s, another approach to organizing workers was created. The Federation of Trade and Labor Unions is founded in 1881, and in 1886, it changes its name to the American Federation of Labor, the predecessor to what we know today as the AFL-CIO. Founded by Samuel Gompers, a cigar maker, along with several other skilled workers, the AFL emerged with a very different approach to things than the Knights of Labor. It was a federation of mostly craft unions, meaning that for the most part, it organized workers according to their craft. Craft workers tended to be the most highly skilled workers, the workers who were paid the most, who had the most resources. So within the AFL, you would have a union of printers, of steel workers, of carpenters, etc., all the different kinds of crafts coming together in this federation. In the late 19th century, what you have is workers have to find a path to opposing the new capitalist order. And they can do it by coming together in broad solidarities. They can do it through political action, or they can assume a more defensive posture and focus on a unionism that will mostly just represent the most highly skilled workers.
Despite the exclusionary policies of the AFL, the flame of labor activism in the United States continued to spread. Union membership continued to grow exponentially, increasing 20-fold between the years 1886 and 1905, and resulting in over 35,000 separate strikes. Homestead Steelworks factory in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, workers were being pushed to the brink. One out of 11 steelworkers died while on the job, often due to lack of sleep. Pay between workers and management was grotesquely unequal. And new technologies were de-skilling workers and driving them further into poverty. When labor actions resulted, the owner of the factory, Andrew Carnegie, fled to Scotland. Publicly supporting labor unions, he privately wrote to the plant's manager, Henry Frick, that he should reorganize the whole affair. Far too many men are required by amalgamated rules. Frick went on to hire a private militia known as the Pinkerton Detective Agency. The goal, to intimidate workers into submission.
Not so different from Europe as some would claim, but the U.S. ruling class has always used the most repressive and violent means at their disposal to crush workers when they went out on strike. The U.S. is notable because large corporations tended to have their own private militias or armies. And when they did it, they would hire what was then, you know, the most famous company was known as the Pinkertons, but they would hire basically private armies to come in and do battle with workers. And I mean, I'm talking about armed, using whatever weapons they could, killing workers as often as they wanted to, and getting away with it.
There were many different companies that created detective agencies, and their specific goal was to have them there and ready to serve as watchmen, as guards, to infiltrate unions and radical movements, and to break strikes, and often to incite riots, to serve as agent provocateurs. Pinkerton's agency became famous, founded in 1850. By the late 19th century, it was the best known detective agency and was active in many of the most important strikes in the period. From the government investigations into their activities and from a few exposés by men who had served as Pinkertons, we know that they used a wide range of nefarious tactics to achieve their ends. Terence Powderly, the leader of the Knights of Labor, once said, "Whenever we saw that Pinkertons had been assigned to work as watchmen, we had to get our own guys to be watchmen, to watch over the watchmen." And we would see them doing things like laying dynamite on railroad tracks or inciting men to engage in riots. So there's an entire world of really quite shadowy infiltrations, creation of goon squads to go in and bust up heads, that sort of thing. It's an important part of the history of labor in the United States. A great example of this is the Homestead Strike of 1892, easily one of the most important strikes in United States history. It was centered in the steel industry. Steel workers had a strong union. They were among the most powerful and militant of all workers in the United States.
The Homestead struggle is motivated by the skilled workers who belong to an organization called the Sons of Vulcan. And they're fighting not only to get better wages and shorter hours, but also to try to forestall these organizational changes that are going on. Frick hires Pinkertons, and there's this hugely dramatic moment where the Pinkertons come floating up the Monongahela River, because, of course, all of these industrial facilities sit on rivers, both in order to ship their stuff more cheaply and in order to dump their crap into the water. And so here come the Pinkertons up on a raft.
On the morning of July 6th, a tugboat appeared on the Monongahela River, towing a barge of 300 Pinkertons. Tipped off by other workers, the strikers in Homestead armed themselves with rifles and awaited their arrival. A standoff ensued. Then a gunshot rang out. Were then marched through a gauntlet of townspeople, where they suffered verbal and sometimes physical abuse. Remarkably, none of the prisoners were killed and were ultimately set free. On July 12th, Governor Robert E. Pattison sent in the National Guard. The troops were used to protect strikebreakers, which in turn led to the defeat of the Union.
Free Speech TV.
Hold on, everybody. Last session here. I'm going to go a little bit over, but that seems to be...
The strike by now has been pretty much defeated. This defeat became a signal one in the history of U.S. labor. It would not be until the 1930s that you would have a strong union in the steel industry again as a result of this. So by breaking the back of the steel union, employers had really profoundly weakened the entire labor movement.
Trials from the time period reveal a widespread knowledge of the duplicitous tactics used by private detective agencies. In response to the Homestead strike, 160 workers were charged with treason and murder, but not a single jury would convict. The entire strike committee was then arrested and charged. Again, no convictions resulted. Henry Frick was not charged for his role in the conflict, prompting one man to take matters into his own hands. On July 23rd, an anarchist named Alexander Berkman walked into Frick's office in downtown Pittsburgh and fired at him from point-blank range. The gun jammed after one shot. Survived the attack. Berkman spent the next 14 years in prison.
Citizenship in the context of class conflict and class struggle produces the Chinese Exclusion Act. There were major strikes within the rail system, and Chinese workers were a significant part of the railroad workforce, especially in the western part of the country. The movement to exclude the Chinese developed in the context of that labor struggle and in the context of a great economic crisis that had happened a few years before. Both Democrat and Republican parties, and even smaller parties, began to promote the idea that a solution for the immediate crisis is the exclusion of Chinese workers. And while there were minority voices opposing this, especially among socialists at the time, the dominant voice, one that united the whole working class and whole sections of the middle class and penetrated into the working class, was to exclude the Chinese, to drive the Chinese out. And so the exclusion of Chinese represents the first comprehensive exclusionary immigration policy primarily based on race. And it begins a shift in our immigration policy in which now immigration policy is going to be defined more increasingly as a means of excluding people based on race, based on class, based on politics, rather than including people and encouraging people to come.
Race, gender, ethnicity were used to divide workers against one another. If we think about what employers were trying to achieve in this period, in their eyes, their goal was to reduce their labor costs. And they did that by introducing technologies that allowed them to de-skill workers. They did it by opposing unionization. And they did it by finding workers they could hire more cheaply and control more easily. And so increasingly, for employers, the use of different kinds of workers became really important. They recruited labor from Europe, first German and Irish, and then later Southern and Eastern Europeans, Hungarians, Italians. They recruited women into certain industries. They recruited, as time went by, they recruited Mexicans. They looked for Chinese or Japanese when they could, all in an as part of this larger effort to undercut the power of their workers and to reduce their costs. They became, over time, very, very deliberate and careful and strategic about this. And you can find in the written record, when you, especially when you look beyond the northeast of the United States to other parts of the country, you can see employers laying out in their letters their concern to bring in different workers to undercut the power of those that are already there. Think about the plantations in Hawaii, for example. I've seen letters where employers say the Japanese have too much control, too much power, we have to do something. We want an okay from the United States government to bring in Filipinos and Puerto Ricans. And so they do. And so several thousand Puerto Ricans and Filipinos go to work in the cane fields of Hawaii. And the same official then writes, it has been a splendid experiment. The Japanese now know they are not the only worker. We've been able to cut their wages. So with experiments like that, employers, planters, steel owners learn that using different kinds of workers can be one of their best weapons. Scholars studying who's working in steel mills in the early 20th century have found that employers would bring in people from different parts of Europe, people who spoke different languages, and having them work right next to each other, specifically so that it would be harder for them to organize. If you can't even communicate in the same language, it's going to be bloody difficult to form a union and protest what the employer is demanding of you.
In the late 19th century, an increasing number of workers began to recognize that they could not successfully mobilize under the robber barons without overcoming their own racial and cultural prejudices. One of the most remarkable strikes occurred in New Orleans, 1892. When Teamsters, Scalesmen, and Packers united under what they called the Triple Alliance. Their demands included a 10-hour workday, overtime pay, and a union shop. In the words of one historian, the New Orleans strike represented the first general strike in American history to enlist both and unskilled labor, black and white, and to paralyze the life of a great city. Delivery of food ceased. Streetcars remained idle. Electrical and gas workers walked off the job, plunging the city into darkness and revealing the stars. During the strike, the New Orleans press repeatedly tried to stoke the flames of racial hatred. Newspapers ran fabricated stories about mobs of black men harassing and beating up whites. The Triple Alliance abandoned their fight after the governor threatened to bring in the National Guard, but they maintained racial solidarity throughout the campaign. There was this mass strike in 1892 in New Orleans, uniting basically the entire black and white working class of New Orleans. Workers, for example, at the docks, were organized into biracial unions, so they were segregated within the same union local. But on the job, dock workers, mine workers, etc., the danger of the job and the physical effort that goes into it tended to really break down racial divisions in those occupations first and foremost. So it was very significant. It was crushed, but then within a decade or so afterwards, there was another mass strike in New Orleans in which black and white workers again united. In the meantime, the local ruling class decided to make Jim Crow. Jim Crow was essentially a response to populism, the enforcement of separation of the races. It was legally sanctioned in the South. In the North, you had basically de facto racial segregation. So it was really a nationwide phenomenon. So basically, what did the U.S. ruling class do? They made it illegal for blacks and whites to share any public space together. They made it illegal for blacks and whites to marry. By the 1930s in Alabama, it was against the law to agitate for any kind of equal rights. That was the kind of the weapon that developed, that the U.S. corporate class developed in response to things like the New Orleans strike in 1892. The New Orleans strike was emblematic of a growing spirit of solidarity between workers. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it would find political expression in the People's Party, the Socialist Party, and the Progressive Movement. More importantly, it would lead to the formation of the Industrial Workers of the World, the most radical union in the history of the United States.
Okay, everybody. I think it's metanoiafilms.org where you could go and you could see this again if you wanted to spell it here. It's right here coming up. Just one second here. metanoia-films.org. So we have one song that we want to play, and Rama picked it, and it's called Angel of Music. So let's do that and make that spirit of Happy New Year here come in. Okay, here we go.
there.
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's coming.
No, no, no.
Rama, that's not playing any. There it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes.
Brava, brava, bravies.
Where in the world have you been hiding? Really, you were perfect. I only wish I knew your secret. Who is your great tutor?
Meg, when your mother brought me here to live, whenever I'd come down here alone to light a candle for my father, a voice from above. And in my dreams, he was always there. You see, when my father lay dying, he told me I would be protected by an angel. An angel of music.
Christine, do you believe? Do you think the spirit of your father's coaching you?
Who else, Meg? Who?
Father once spoke of an angel. I used to dream he'd appear. Now as I sing, I can sense him, and I know he's here. Here in this room, he calls me softly, somewhere inside, hiding. Must have been dreaming. Stories like this can't come true. Christine, you're talking in riddles, and it's not like you. It's only music, my dear father.
Say it, Rama.
Andre, this is doing nothing for my nerves.
That's okay. Okay. That's from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera. That was a beautiful little section there. Let's bring in the feminine. Let's wish the Happy New Year here. And let's keep our point of unity. I thought that was very well done. History, everyone. There's more. With these elders coming in, it's a lovely doe whose delicate beauty belongs in a fairy tale. We're back to our unicorn tale, stepping through tall reeds, which lash her silvery sides black with zebra stripes. And this is in the jungles in Africa here. And the next page, sit in midst of decorated chanting, exotically handsome people, around whom spreads the most exotic of landscapes, inhabited by the most exotic of creatures. Yes, and I think that the reality now of living beings that are here to help, to bring things back, into a balance. So much assistance, everyone. And we are all one. It's the bewitching after hour of almost quarter after 10. So we'll see you. Happy New Year. You know, it's Mela Kaliki Maka E Ha E. Oh, I'm not sure I got that one by my own, by heart yet. I think I got it here. Ha U Oli Maka Hiki Hau. Happy New Year. And Rama, we are all another ourselves. So inshallah and Sat Nam.
Tat Nam Ti.
Ahomi Takuyasan and Music Maestro. Namaste, everybody. See you tomorrow. Namaste.